Good evening. How are we?
Great.
Yeah. Listen, I'm so happy that not only that you're here, but you actually found a parking spot. Right? Those are Joe here. It's rare that a music festival starts on a Thursday in Vinoy Park, so that is the issue we're dealing with here. But anyway, so welcome. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Rui Frias. I'm the director of the Museum of History. And again, thanks for coming to Happy Hour with a Historian. This has turned into our favorite thing that we do here at the museum and that we share with the public. I want to talk to you about a few upcoming events that we have here at the museum. Like for instance, this Saturday is our Liquid to Land historic boat tour that we do with Tampa Bay Watch. And Wednesday, March 20th, our haunted trolley tour returns. We'll start doing monthly starting next week. And I want to thank all of you. There's some people here that attended our History in a Bottle event last month that featured rum prohibition in the 1920s. It was actually an amazing event, and we started History in a Bottle with a wine tasting late last year, and then decided to move it forward. It's been so successful, we'll actually do it three more times this year. On May 3rd, we're doing a bourbon tasting, of course, because what happens the next day on May 4th? Thank you, the Kentucky Derby, right? On August 10th, we'll be doing a tequila tasting, not shots tasting, right? And then on November 2nd, we'll be doing another wine tasting. These events are not just drinking events. They're paired with amazing catering that ties into the food and deals with the region from where the spirits or the wine are from. But it's also a history lesson because Sharon, the woman who does this presentation, does an amazing job talking about the history of what you're tasting and what you're about to enjoy that evening. So please, if you haven't signed up for our emails or follow us on social media, check out our website. All this information is on there. If you're not a member, tonight is the perfect night to join. We've just started a membership campaign where we want to grow our membership to 100 new members this month before the end of March. So again, if you're not a member, you can do it tonight. All you have to do is sign up at the desk. Cameron will take care of you, and you'll be joining our History Museum family. You also get some freebies. Not only do you get discounts for our events, and you can come to the museum whenever you want, but we're looking at a few other events, like on June 8th, which is the anniversary of the Orange Belt Railway arriving in what is now St. Petersburg. We're going to be doing an event that evening, and then we're looking to return to our cookout event, Perfect Spot for Fireworks Watching, on July 4th. Right, so we'll be sending information out to you on that. So some special thanks tonight to the City of St. Petersburg, the Boehner Charitable Trust, the Vinoy Hotel, the Tampa Bay Times, the Residences at 400 Central, Adelphi Trust, and Hennessy Construction. And of course, the presenting sponsor of Happy Hour, Southern Roots Realty. Natalie DeVicente, the owner and broker of the realty firm, usually speaks, but she is spring break. She has young children. They are not here, right? But we couldn't do this without Southern Roots' help. They sponsored it last year and eagerly signed on to help this year. So let's talk about tonight's speaker. Tonight's speaker has a bachelor's degree in anthropology from Eckerd College and has been working for the museum since early 2019. She started at the front desk, but it didn't take as long to realize how valuable she is. And now she sits high above the museum, right over there, protecting our city's history as the archives and collections manager. Even though she's a country girl from Ohio, she quickly took an interest in women's history in St. Petersburg, began researching projects which eventually evolved into the exhibit Meddling the Women Who Built St. Pete, which she curated, and which is still on exhibit back there in our main gallery. Her research into this subject continues to evolve, and she's interested in uncovering more about pioneer St. Pete women's political movements and LGBTQ+ history. And museum founder Mary Wheeler Eaton sent me a message saying that she forgives Jesse for talking about Sarah first here at Happy Hour. Ladies and gentlemen, Jesse Breckenridge.
Hello.
coin flip that decided the name of St. Petersburg. Who here has heard Rui try to prove that wrong? Who knows who started that rumor?
Rui!
Nice.
Well, have you ever thought maybe it was Sarah? So, this is what I believe to be the origin of our coin flip myth, and in this case they use straws. This is the 1917 obituary of Sarah Armistead, formerly Sarah Williams, formerly Sarah Judge, formerly Sarah Craven, also known as the mother of St. Petersburg. And right here is the claim that not only did Peter Demenz and John C. Williams draw the straws for the naming rights of St. Petersburg, but also that she held the straws herself. Here it is again, with the added note that she also named the Detroit Hotel. How industrious of her. Of course, we do know now that the coin flip myth is a myth. There was probably never any drawing of straws, probably never any coin flip. The truth is a much less interesting clerical adventure. Rui can tell you all about that. So, who supplied this information? Who started the rumor? Probably Sarah. Here is a first-hand account from someone who knew her, saying that Sarah used to tell the story herself. Why? It's possible we'll never know. So maybe the question is, who was Sarah Armistead, and where did she get off making claims like that? Let's start back at the beginning, back when she was just Sarah Craven. Her mother's name was Isabella Stewart, and that's about as much as we can know, given that it was the early 1800s and she was a woman. Sarah's father was James Craven, who, according to some records, was a barber. According to Sarah, was a soldier. And according to his obituary, was a drunk. All or none of these things could be the truth, aside from the thing about the barber. That one's pretty well documented. Sarah was the firstborn. She had four siblings, but none of these names will come up later, so you can forget them. Her upbringing is a mystery, but if you can picture a Jane Austen novel, it was nothing like that. First off, she was born in 1843, about 30 years too late, and also in Canada. We don't know what kind of income her parents had, so we can only speculate on her education or really any other part of her early life. She makes no other appearance in newspapers, for better or for worse, and she finally does show up in the 1861 census, interestingly, alone, in some other family's household, but the rest of the information that we can gather about that, female, age 17, is hardly revealing. It isn't until she's 27 that we get a better picture of who Sarah Craven is. This is the first time her name appears in newspapers. An embezzlement scandal. Do you see? She's accused of embezzling $1,700 from someone named Giles Pullman. This lady, the mother of St. Petersburg, she doesn't exactly look like a hardened criminal, so let's look at her this way. She's much younger here, probably in her 20s or 30s, going off her clothes, which works perfectly for what's about to happen. Sometime in the early 1860s, we believe that Sarah starts performing as a singer, dancer, and actress under the stage name Nellie Haywood, or Nellie Hayward. There's an unsurprising amount of inconsistency here. Around the same time, Johnny Judge starts showing up in newspapers. He's listed as a comedian. He's likely doing blackface and minstrel performances. But by the time he and Nellie Haywood share ad space, he is listed as a champion banjoist. It's unclear if they knew each other before performing together, but over the course of the 1860s, they have two children together, Robert and John. They don't stop performing, though. Going off of census records and newspaper appearances, it seems like for part of the year, Sarah and Judge feed their kids with some friends to travel across the country performing. Sort of like a little kid's pipe dream, only the kids get left behind and the parents go in circus. Dr. Thayer's circus is the remnant of Thayer and Noyes' circus, which is one of the largest of its kind in the 1860s. It once showcased everything from elephants to acrobats, but by 1870, Thayer and Noyes had split, and the circus downsized significantly. When Dr. Thayer's circus rolled through Tarboro, North Carolina, Its acts were mainly equestrian, comedic, musical, or some combination of the three. From what we can tell, Sarah and Judge were traveling with Thayers as a part of Giles Pullman's theater troupe. They're in Tarboro when Pullman allegedly entrusts her with $1,700. For reference, that is over $40,000 today. She's supposed to take this money up to Raleigh, which is the next stop on the circuit. Only she never shows. Instead, she heads north, back to Detroit, where she and Judge have long since set up their home base. Giles Pullman reports the crime on November 1st, and with suspicious timing, Sarah and Judge decide to legally marry on November 21st, 1870. And yes, before anyone asks, even back then, spouses could not be forced to testify against one another, and it's not a leap to say the judges knew this too. Within the week, both Sarah and John Judge are brought before a judge. They both plead not guilty and pay $2,000 each for bail, about $94,000 total in today's money. After being released, they go to examination the next day. At this examination, it was determined that John Judge had nothing to do with it, and he was released. Sarah, however, was pulled into a trial that lasted well into January. The reason for this hinged on testimony from none other than the circus's bearded lady, Madame Rebecca Lyle, who claimed she had overheard Sarah saying she had Pullman's money. But ultimately, Sarah was released and the charges were dismissed, though not for the reason you'd think. Based on the recounting of events, the court said that if Sarah had stolen the money, her crime would have been considered larceny, not embezzlement. And that, it seems, is that. Pullman never pursues any further charges. Sarah and John Judge continue on as performers, and they even attempt to make their own circus, the Judge and Davis Palace Pavilion Show. This ad features Johnny Judge and Nellie Haywood, but only shows up one singular time in Wisconsin before being briefly mentioned in Michigan and disappearing entirely. Then, in 1875, at the age of 36, John Judge dies of consumption. This likely didn't spell great things for Sarah and the boys. The local theater comique for which both Sarah and Judge worked put on a benefit for the family, and in the years that follow, Sarah shows up frequently in their advertisements. In a strange interlude, she appears to marry a man named Frank Martin, who is well known for being a musician, a fraud, a swindler, and not necessarily in that order. But aside from their marriage record, nothing ties the two of them together, not even a divorce record. Martin leaves Detroit pretty soon after, and for all intents and purposes, Sarah carries on her life like it never happened. Then, by 1880, Sarah's son Robert starts working for John C. Williams. For those of you playing a drinking game, for every time I say John, call your Ubers now. This is the third John in the story, and probably the first you'll recognize. I'm sure you've seen his portrait in the museum. This is the father of St. Petersburg, one of them, anyways. Prior to that whole saga, John Williams is a farmer living outside Detroit with his 12 million children and his wife, Charlotte. But by 1873, he's opened up a real estate office near downtown Detroit. And then famously, in 1876, he buys property in what was then known as Pinellas Point. Over the next few years, he tries to set up a plantation here. By 1879, he's said to own around 2,500 acres, but his crops keep failing. And he only uses a small portion of it for an orange grove. Now, Robert Judge starts working for him in 1880 as a clerk in his Detroit real estate office. And by that April, John Williams files for divorce. And within 2 years, he marries Robert's mom, our very own Sarah Craven Judge. What a crazy random happenstance. Charlotte doesn't seem to think so. Years later, she'll come back into the picture just in time to stake a claim in John's estate, and she'll allege that Sarah and John have been carrying on long before he and Charlotte were officially divorced. We can't really blame her for this accusation. Turnabout's fair play. John and Charlotte's divorce was messy. John alleged not only 30 years of domestic wretchedness, but threats on his life, and infidelity too. At one point, a man named Charles Althaus claimed that he had, as the newspapers put it, carnal intercourse with Charlotte, in a barn, no less. Several people came forward in Charlotte's defense saying that she would never and could never, and that his general reputation for truth and veracity was bad, and that he was drunk more times than he was sober. The back and forth with their divorce ends in November of 1881, and according to St. Pete historian Carl Grismer, and literally no one else, John Williams and Sarah Judge are married 9 months later on July 29, 1882. Wow. For the next few years, the Williamses start to establish a life in Florida. Contrary to popular belief, Sarah and John Williams do not pick up their lives permanently in Detroit and settle in John's land in Tampa, nor do they do so in Pinellas Point. They do build an impressive home in Hyde Park and regularly go back and forth between there and Michigan as they try to establish a plantation in Pinellas. At some point, some of Williams' kids, as well as Sarah's son, Robert Judge, decide to settle in Pinellas a lot more permanently. The result of this is the first hint that there might be some animosity between the Williams family and the Judge family. In August of 1882, just a month after Sarah and John are said to have been married, John's son, John R. Williams, opens fire on Sarah's son, Robert. It's a drive-by shooting via a one-horse wagon, and it misses. It hits someone named Robert Hodge instead, but apparently John R. Williams had been acting erratically for a while, and when he was charged, they declared him insane, and he was sent away to an asylum in Chattanooga. Now let's get into the good bit. The founding of St. Petersburg. If you know anything about the story, you know that in 1887, John Williams and Peter Demens struck a deal. If John provided the land, Peter would bring the Orange Belt Railway to town. If you know a little bit more about it, you know that Peter was practically bankrupt when the deal was made. And if you know a little bit more than that, you know that he was so broke that when the deal with John Williams was struck, he was too busy wining and dining creditors up north to be there in person. Peter, who was a Russian expat, had only gotten a hold of the Orange Belt in 1885 when the railroad company couldn't pay him back for lumber he'd supplied for their ties. Taking an opportunity where he saw one, he started pursuing his dream to build a new St. Petersburg somewhere, anywhere, really. He created a town near Lake Apopka called Oakland. Whatever the reason they couldn't call that town St. Petersburg, Peter wanted a second shot at it. And this time, he got in touch with Hamilton Diston, who was in the process of trying to make Gulfport a thing. Diston was the one to bring Demens to the Pinellas Peninsula in the hopes that his burgeoning town, what was then called Diston City, could become a major destination for tourists and industrialists alike. But before the deal went through, Demens, or rather his partner, Henry Sweetapple, got a better offer. Now, Henry Sweetapple had a long storied life before he wound up in Pinellas Peninsula, but the most important thing you need to know about him is that he's Canadian. English born, sure, but when it came time to sit with John and Sarah Williams, it was his life in Canada that came up in conversation. Because as we now know, who else was from Canada? Sarah. Reportedly, she and Henry Sweetapple got on like a house on fire. Historian Raymond Arsenault cites that she was an intelligent, cultured woman with a disarming manner, and that she took the lead throughout the negotiations. In later accounts, well, Sarah's obituary, so, grain of salt. The founding of St. Petersburg was a task that John and Sarah underwent together. It wasn't just John, it wasn't just John and Peter. It was John, Sarah, Henry, and from a distance, Peter. This is the actual document that laid out the agreement between John, Sarah, and the Orange Belt, and as you can see, it was signed by Henry Sweetapple, John Williams, and Sarah Williams. Yes, this circle counts as a signature. Now, Sarah didn't sign this as a landowner, per se, but rather as an acknowledgement that once her husband signed over this land, she no longer had any claim to it. So does that make her a founder? And if it does that make Henry Sweetapple a founder, too? I need somebody smarter than me to figure this out because me and Rui, we can't stop arguing about it. Anyways, Peter Demens gets word from Sweetapple that the deal went through. Here is the 1887 letter he sent to his creditors stating as much. Here, he says, "Just received a report from our Mr. Sweetapple that he succeeded in making an agreement with a certain J.C. Williams. over what he calls a splendid town site. The construction on the railroad begins and, well, we know the rest. Okay, still with me?
Yep.
Okay. Let's fast forward a little bit. It's 1892, 4 years after the first Orange Belt train, the Maddie, puffed and belched its way into safety. This is not the Maddie, but she, like Sarah Armistead, was elusive and hard to photograph. So please, for my ego, pretend it is. Anyways, St. Petersburg, freshly named and steadily growing, decides to incorporate as a town. And the essentials for a town are a council, a police force, and of course, a mayor. John Williams thinks he has it in the bag. Surely the town's founder would be elected as the first mayor, just as his father had been the first mayor of Detroit. Plus, he's running on the pro-saloon ticket, and mom, the people of St. Pete have always loved to drink. It's a sure thing, for sure. Whoopsie. Out of the 31 people who voted, only 10 picked John Williams. David Moffat, a citrus farmer with a fantastic mustache who had backing from local prohibition advocates, he gets the other 21. Then, in what must have been a swift kick to the gut for a man already on the ground, John's own son wins a seat on the council, running on the anti-saloon ticket alongside David Moffat. Enraged, Williams challenges the legality of the election. It's an effort that ultimately fails. Now, it should be noted that a year previously, John Williams had drawn up a will that states, in no uncertain terms, quote, "As my children have not loved or cared for me as I think they should have, I do not desire that they should enjoy any of my property." So, on April 26, 1892, about 2 months after the election, to put the finest of points on how mad he was, John C. Williams dies. And he leaves everybody but Sarah with nothing. Naturally, this begins one of the largest court cases that Florida had ever seen, at least at that point. There was, after all, $150,000 on the line. Today, that's $5.4 million. Eight of the Williams kids banded together to block the 1891 will. Their claim that their father was in a demented state when he wrote it, and that Sarah used undue influence to confuse him to write it. Furthermore, they claimed that John and Sarah were never even legally married, and therefore she cannot be considered his widow. And indeed, only historian Carl Grismer seems to know the exact date of their marriage. And to be fair, he did know the family, but no official record of their marriage has ever turned up. Then, just to make matters worse, Charlotte Williams comes out of the woodwork. Remember her, John's first wife? She claims that at the time of their divorce, John Williams was unbalanced and that he had terrified her into dropping the case against him in the divorce. So being so terrified and ignorant of the law, she should have a claim to the money as a kind of permanent alimony. Now, this case is pretty important in St. Pete because most of John's money is tied up in property. So whoever gets the highest payout will end up owning a large chunk of the property in and around the city. The extensive proceedings of the court case can still be found today in property records of many areas in St. Pete, if, of course, you go back far enough. When the estate is finally settled in August of 1894, Charlotte is given a flat $5,000, and the rest is split in a compromise between Sarah Williams and all of the Williams children. Sarah retained $30,000, which John had given her before he died, and one-third of the $150,000 estate. The rest was to be divided equally among the eight children. All of this to say that when Sarah's second, possibly third, husband dies, she walks away with what would be the equivalent of $2.9 million. This makes her one of, if not the richest woman in town, and one of the largest property owners, too. So what does she do then? Turn around and marry the soon-to-be mayor, of course. On September 7th, 1894, effectively 1 month after the Williams estate is settled, but also, to be fair, over 2 years since her last husband died, Sarah Williams marries Captain James A. Armistead. That's the best picture we have of him, unfortunately. Armistead was a decorated Civil War veteran who had moved to Pinellas for the health of his first wife, Ollie, in 1885. He worked primarily in real estate, but when Ollie dies in 1893, he remarries to our very own Sarah Craven Judge Williams and helps her in the management of her now massive estate. Later, he goes on to serve for four terms as the mayor of St. Petersburg from 1896 to 1900, before dying in 1907, giving Sarah even more land. Around the same time that things settle down for her, legally speaking, Sarah starts to get more involved with her community. Before John's death, she had been the project manager for the construction of the Williams Methodist Episcopal Church in 1890, which may or may not be the first congressional church, congregational church that once stood where the open-air post office is today. She was involved in building the Williams Mansion in 1892, which later became a part of the Manhattan Hotel, and still stands today, used by USF as classroom and office space. She also built the Armistead House off of 3rd Avenue, which unfortunately no longer stands. In 1893, she becomes a founding member of the Women's Town Improvement Association, whose first goal is to take the space that John Williams had originally platted to be a city park and make it a habitable, desirable place to be. You may know it today as Williams Park, creatively called. For an unknown number of years in the early 1900s, she also serves as the president of the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, ironically on the opposite side of the prohibition debate as her late husband. She and Captain Armistead go on to build a three-story opera house across the street from the Detroit that would later become Taft Hotel. As an opera house, it would host a traveling entertainment troupes like the one Sarah had been a part of in her younger years, and on occasion, she would even grace the stage herself for charity. And of course, she strategically sold and donated pieces of the Williams and Armistead land, both to individuals and to the city of St. Petersburg for the benefit of public works. The animosity between her and the Williams children, though, never seemed to die down. In 1900, Captain Armistead and his son run into J. Mott Williams, one of John's sons, in a grocery store. For reasons unknown, Armistead starts beating him with his cane while his son holds him down. Of course, they're arrested and taken to court on charges of disturbing the peace. Armistead says, in essence, "You can't charge me, I'm the mayor." To which the judge says, "I can and I will." Armistead is fined $5 and his son $1. But who knows, maybe the feud is one-sided. Sarah's son, Robert, after all, ended up naming one of his children after John C. Williams. Or perhaps it wasn't, we may never know. Because despite the mountains of newspaper mentions, the multiple marriages and legal battles, there is little we know about Sarah Armistead the person. Many of the stories that touch on her personality are either vague, like this one. But this one, I mean, what does noble even mean? Or they seem to be exaggerated, or in the case of the naming of St. Pete, they're probably fictions that have long been accepted as fact. Today we look at the evidence of her life and we want to tell a good story with it. Here's a woman who stole from the circus and got away with it, except we don't know if that's true. Here's a woman who had three, maybe four husbands die young. Maybe she's a black widow, except we can't prove that either. Either she is a woman perpetually in the wrong place at the wrong time, or she is a schemer who always outwits the marks. What we can say is this: Sarah Craven Judge Williams Armistead dies on December 14, 1917, and was buried in Detroit next to John Williams, with the equivalent of $3 million to her name. We want to sensationalize that because it's fun, but in Sarah's case, the evidence can point to an interesting but noble life as easily as it can point to a life of crime. But after a long, bizarre life, I think she's allowed a couple of secrets. Now, the research that went into this presentation would have been impossible without Kathy Petrakis, who volunteers with me upstairs. She has spent days of her life in pulling all this information into the light, and it was actually her who found this specific photo when she was putting together Sarah's ancestry tree. Somebody contacted her, so they had a stack of labeled photos that they never knew what to do with. This is a remarkable find. But thank you all so much, and I would love to take some questions if you have them.
I do not have any questions about this. So she died for it.
So she died worth $3 million. Is there records as to how she bequeathed that?
What was the question?
He asked the $3 million that she had. What happened to that after she died? So a portion of it, it went to charity, her children, the city of St. Pete, I believe, as well, and
The city got money for a firehouse.
City got money for a firehouse,
and then she bequeathed money to all of her brothers and sisters, all of her nieces and nephews, all of her children and grandchildren.
Any of the Williams kids?
Yep.
So literally everybody else who wasn't a Williams got money. That's what it seems like.
One of Armistead's sons was an executor.
The Armistead sons did, though.
So was she involved in the women's suffrage movement?
I haven't found anything explicitly tying her to that. The women's suffrage movement was starting to gain some traction in St. Pete around that time. So the St. Pete Women's Club was founded in 1912. And it was pretty much right after that that we start seeing official meetings on suffrage. And that would have been like the last 5 years of her life. And they're really just starting to gear up in those last couple of years, making it more than just not idle conversation. They were having actual meetings about it, but taking it from that to actual like lobbying was really happening at the end of her life. So maybe, but.
You didn't find any connection between her mother, Isabella Stewart, and Isabella Stewart Gardner, who has that house in Boston, who was in the 19th century and traveled a lot all over Europe collecting art.
I don't think so. I'm kind of out of it. There was an article that said at one point that Sarah was going up to visit her family's castle that she had a family castle in Canada, which we found no solid connection to, but other than that, that's really any sort of indication that she might have grown up in any sort of wealth. I don't think so, yeah.
Just curious, if you looked up and talked to or found any of her descendants that might still be around the Tampa area?
I haven't.
I found no living relatives yet. Neither of her sons had descendants here. One went to California, one was in Buffalo.
There's possibly no living descendants, is what she said, that her two sons...
Don't you dare.
Her two sons went to Buffalo and to...
One son spent much of his life in Buffalo, and the other one went to California. I started with the one in California and haven't found any living descendants yet. I'm not sure about the one in Buffalo.
Was it odd, or is it just coincidence, or is there a story as to how she was buried with William in Detroit?
It is certainly odd. By most standards, she should have been buried with John Judge. And that tends to be the way it goes, is that you get buried with your first husband. I don't even think John was her longest husband, but because
they were only legally married for 5 years before he died. Then Williams was roughly 10 years, and then Armistead was also less than 10 years, I think, before he died. We don't know where John Judge is buried, if he was buried.
It could be related to that, but there's just no...
I don't think they had money when her first husband died, so he's possibly in a pauper's grave somewhere in Detroit, or he was from New York. I don't know what happened to him. I'm kind of really surprised that she did get married though with Williams, considering she died so many years after him and the family did not like her.
A little paranoid. Is there any statement on why her husbands, ranging from 5 to 10 years, died?
Well, you know, there are a few running theories. I mean, John Williams was in his 70s when he died, late 70s when he died. It was 1892. I don't think that James Armistead was crazy old or anything. I mean, John Jeff was 36, but he also got tuberculosis, so.
John Williams was 30 years older than Sarah. She was roughly the age of some of his children.
Anyone else?
Good. Thank you so much.
Hello. One of the important things is between Kathy and Jesse, they're not finished with this research. Right, so this is stuff that we talked about at the very beginning that Jesse and Kathy started finding when they were doing research for the exhibit. As they dive deeper down these rabbit holes, they'll get more stuff and we'll be back with all that information. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, you couldn't tell.